Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 70. For those of you new to the show, my name's Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, the live circuit. Angel Comedy is one of the most sought-after and highly respected comedy nights in London. Having only started 6 years ago, it was built up from nothing, having gone from a small room above a pub in Islington to recently where they had a crowdfunding campaign supported by the community of performers and loyal audience that they've accumulated over the better part of a decade to buy their own pub and convert it into a purpose-built comedy venue. I got on half of the original founders, Barry Ferns and Sarah Pierce, to talk about how they've built a community around their club, and most interestingly, how they did it through the pay-what-you-want model of letting people come in for free and give what they can on the way out. I should say now they also offer ticketed shows as well as the free shows, but the whole thing has fascinated me, and I hope it does you as well. Very quickly, in the full interest of disclosure, if you've listened to the happy two-year anniversary pod that I put out a few weeks ago, you'll know that I said I was starting an LGBT kink themed comedy night and podcast. The podcast has had to be delayed slightly. I'm happy to announce that that gig will be taking place at the Bill Murray, which is the name of the pub that Angel Comedy owns through the crowdsourcing campaign in Islington in London. Full details and links are in the show notes, and if you'd like to get yourself a ticket for the January date, which is Sunday the 22nd, I would really like to pack it out that night and show the venue that there is an audience for that concept. They're being amazingly supportive and just so helpful and just exactly what you'd expect from a community-led project like this. So if you can make it, please do come. If you can't make it, please share the link with a friend who can or who might be interested, or just invite them to the event on Facebook. Every little bit of that helps, and I can't thank you enough if you do any of it. If you're new here, please hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please consider giving us a review in iTunes. But for now, this is Barry Ferns and Sarah Pierce.
Well, you began it.
What? How did Angel Comedy begin? Angel Comedy started off as an open mic night on a Thursday and a regular night, a professional night on a Saturday. I had been doing stand-up for maybe 6 months solidly. I'd done bits and bobs before that. I also did more stand-up when I was much younger, and then I did sketch comedy, so I had been done some Mirth Control gigs. Roddy Fraser ran a gig at the bathhouse. His gig was always great, but you had to fly for about 2 hours for it. They sometimes could pay you for, which was nice of him. Other times it was free if he didn't have enough people in, but you'd fly in Leicester Square, often out in the cold, and because it was often cold, you know, for a couple of hours. And it's great because it was a good thing to go and do, because you'd get an audience, and that was it. The audience was gold. And other times I was going and doing Mirth Control gigs and traveling up and down the country and paying like £20 or £30 essentially in petrol money to go and being in a car, which was really interesting. I like being in cars with comedians. It's fun. So doing all these different things and actually losing quite a lot of time and money doing other gigs. And the idea, so running a open mic gig was an interesting thing to do. But in terms of a Saturday gig, it was like I was really bored and tired of playing to an audience that were just either open micers or, and that was it. So I came up with the idea to take the money that I was losing from traveling around the country and performing to no people often, or five people, you know, a Mirth Control gig. I remember going to, you know, you go to these far-flung places and there are five people in the audience, and, you know, because at the time, I don't know Mirth Control's like anymore, but at the time, I think the venue would pay for the comedy to be there, so the venue was publicising it, and Mirth would get a set rate, and that would pay for the comedians, and they'd get their cut. So I was losing all this money doing stand-up, and I thought, well, I'll tell you what, instead of losing all this money doing stand-up in different places and investing all this time, I could lose this money on my own terms. So the idea was, behind Angel Comedy, was initially, right, what I'll do is I'll get myself and some of my friends that are doing comedy, of which Sarah is one of them. And so the idea was initially to run a gig on a Saturday night that has a paid for headline act and some other really good new people. And the incentive for the new people is to perform in front of an audience. And the incentive for the headline act is they're getting paid, and to offer something for free in order just to get stage time. And I would rather lose £100 on my own terms and try and get an audience than lose £100 over three or four nights performing to five people. And that's where the idea for Angel Comedy came about. So I talked to somebody called Linus Lee about that, and me and Linus started it up, and we're in the Islington Gazette. We kind of contacted them. There's a picture of me and Linus on the front page of the Islington Gazette. And then that started out on a September in 2010. It was once a week on a Saturday, and then it got busy quite quickly. And my girlfriend at the time, Katerina Varana, came along. She was kind of like, we talk about it, but she wasn't quite as invested. But then when it got busy quite quickly, she became involved with that. And Sarah performed at the first few and saw how busy it was and came on board then. And then we had this kind of the four of us, that was me, Linus, Sarah and Katerina, that did it for the first kind of 6 months until Linus left to go to Australia. And also because his material was a bit dark for Saturday night.
Yeah, it was. I was performing at the time, and it was a chance to do really regular shows in front of actual audience members not too far from home. And it was great, and to be able to offer other comedians that as well. And then it just started getting busier and busier and busier, and kind of took a life on its own. And we expanded, so we went from the open mic nights on Thursday and the more kind of professional, we call them professional, because we had the headliners come in, didn't we?
So they were a professionally run night.
Yeah.
And then after about a year and a half, the pub asked if I wanted to do a Sunday night. And then I think that was just me at the time. And I tried to run a night with Deck Monroe a bit. That didn't really work. There was a cinema night that we tried to run. Stuart Silver and Kim Noble came down. There are a couple other people that came down. Never really worked that. And then that became, after about 6 months of trial and error, then that became a new act night as well, because that format seemed to work. And then that worked as well. And then it was three nights a week for another year.
Mm-hmm.
Then after about, it must have been about, so I was running pretty much just me. I mean, Sarah came down for the first little bit.
I came and helped Thursdays,
With somebody called Rich Hutchinson as well, who was regularly kind of helping out. Like, I'd do all the booking and stuff, and then on the night you'd come down and Richard would come down.
So that was like Sundays and Thursdays and Saturdays, wasn't it? And then I remember the pub asked if we could do every night.
Yeah.
And we kind of thought, oh, maybe we could do that, and realised that was kind of a bit too much too quick, and went to 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for that we took our time. And then, so it went from 5 to 7 days. Yeah.
But to begin with, it was, for the first 3 years, it was those two open mic nights and mm-hmm. Saturday night. And then it kind of, in 2013, was it 13?
Yes.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. I can't remember.
you started free, essentially, mm-hmm. and you still pretty much are. And I think outside of Edinburgh, that's something that most people look at and go, how? Like, how do you make money from free? And you do the bucketed thing at the end, but how do you find that works as a model in terms of?
We don't really make money from it. Like, we just wanted to do stage time. So it's so if people want to really become rich on comedy, then perhaps don't do the pay what you can afford model, I guess. But for us, it created such a good atmosphere.
Yeah, it was our priorities were to perform in front of an audience, and what I think a lot of people that ask that question don't really understand is the mentality and the desires of a performer. Like, people often have an idea of how much money somebody's making, or like I was working as a recycling officer for the first 4 years of doing Angel Comedy. It's just important to perform. If you don't get a chance to perform, you don't get a chance to become a stand-up, and there are fewer and fewer opportunities for people to perform in London or in England, and it's tied up by a lot of people that have agents or are, you know, have TV credits or have been around for a long time. So how do you even perform? So it's a bit of a misnomer, I think, the question about sort of like making a, you know, why a free comedy night? How does it work? How the, you know, the financials of it? No. How do you become a stand-up? How do you become a stand-up comedian? That's the question nobody is asking. And a lot of the questions that people ask are, a lot of people that ask questions are promoters. They're interested in money. How's this surviving? How's this business surviving? It's not a business. It's some comedians that want to be comedians. So, you know, it's almost getting the cart before the horse, but it's, you know, just, you have to perform. Like, I don't know, you know, I was desperate to perform, and there was nowhere to perform. So, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm not a performer anymore, so but I wouldn't, yeah, during that period, I wouldn't have called myself a promoter. I'd started studying, I became a student to study psychotherapy, I think, because being surrounded by all these comedians felt like that was the right job.
Market.
Good market, yeah. So, you know, that's how I'm going to make all my money, just by going to, like, yeah, therapizing everybody.
Good luck with that.
But, you know, there was a time when I stopped performing and I was still helping out at Angel Comedy regularly. And for me, again, it not motivated by money, it's motivated by these were my friends, and it was such a fun night to be part of, in terms of the comedians and the audience who was starting to come, and I had a certain amount of pride that this night had been curated and developed so well. It was a lot of fun, yeah, so much fun. And I guess in the last year, things have changed a little.
It's become a lot less fun. Yeah, it's become more torment. Yeah. That's what psychotherapy does.
Yeah, well, it's...
what are the problems underlying?
I was going to say, it has become more of a... like, because we've got a new venue. We got our own venue, and so inevitably that meant that it became more of a formal business where we have to do stuff, do a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah. A lot of businessy stuff.
Why the move to a venue, though? Because if it's doing really well, you've got 7 nights a week, it's packing out, you're turning people away. Most promoters would be like, you know, this is great. I might open up a new room in another pub. Mm-hmm. What you've done is you've leased a pub, which mm-hmm. is kind of a step further than I think most promoters would go. So if you weren't looking at it as a business, it seems like quite a business move to go.
Well, I think for me, what happened with me is, with the success of it, once it had gone 7 nights a week and once we saw that actually there was more capacity for it to grow, I started to think, oh, actually this is, could be something that I do. And so now I perhaps would class myself more as a kind of venue owner, not a promoter. I don't know. It's more an official role, isn't it? I'm a director.
You're everything.
Yeah.
There's a, as well as a therapizer. I think it does something to you running a gig that 50 to 60,000 people coming through the doors every single year, and does something. It seems a bit severe. But you realise, oh, there's a lot of money being made in the bar.
Yeah.
And none of that is going to you. And what could you do with that money? Okay, yeah, you could survive off that money. Yeah. But what could you actually do with it if that was harnessed for good? Like, a big part of the great thing about Angel is the sense of community and everybody else there. And, you know, the fact that it does pay tens on a Friday and Saturday. Where else does it pay 10 on a Friday and Saturday? Fuck, nowhere else. You know, because nobody cares about developing new talent. It's like, we get criticism from a lot of people for kind of being free or undermining or devaluing their product. Just like, well, who else is catering to new comedians? Who else is evolving new comedians? Who else is putting people up from a 5 to a 10? Who else is putting people in front of a big audience? Like, that's like a Saturday or Friday night audience. Nobody else's, you know, agents and other promoters come to our venue to see the new people, and nobody else is doing that, and it's heartbreaking. It's, you know, which is the state of the industry today and why Angel Comedy is successful. But that sense of community is beautiful. It's really nice. There are some amazingly creative, brilliant, sweet, lovely people out there. And there's not really a sense of community in London. And so the idea of having a venue means that, oh, we could help facilitate that. There are some people doing great stuff, like the Free Association are great. Like, they're really doing it around improv and around writing. There's, you know, there aren't, it's not just us running from our own venue. Like, they have their own venue, is my point. But it's just, yeah, that's why we went to the venue, really.
It was really exciting. I mean, I suddenly, like last year, I had the opportunity to go from, as I said, what was practically basically just a hangout thing and something that I had a lot of pride about, kind of this night, and to be given the opportunity to make it into, to go into our own venue, to make it into something bigger, potentially more sustainable, was incredibly exciting. And it felt like, because we were turning so many people away and because I got so much pleasure from those nights, it just felt like, why, yeah, it was too big an opportunity to say no to.
A lot of comedians and a few people caught up in industry, like particularly TV people I've spoken to, have said there isn't really a link between talent that get on TV and the circuit. It's like you were saying before, it's very much tied up by the production house that has it or the agent that owns the production house that makes the program. And it's nice to know that there is somewhere that's trying to bridge that gap. But do you ever think that gap can be properly bridged with so many, I suppose, financial stakes in place? Because there's obviously a reason why they've signed those people and they've made that show and they've pushed them out in that way. As much as the work you do is amazing, do you ever think it's not going to fully bridge because there's so many agendas at play there?
For me, I feel we've got to just carry on doing what we do. And we're creating something. We're creating a chance for different audiences to see different comedians. And that's what I want to do. That's what I want Angel to do. If that can help and go further, yeah, I'm being a bit inarticulate.
That makes sense. I suppose, yeah, in some ways the club is an answer to that Gandhi line, be the change you want to see in the world. So, and that change was personal. Like, I want to... there to be a nice audience to play to if I'm not going to the Glee Club every, you know, every month or the store or anything like that. And not because of a lack of ability, because I think I've rocked those rooms and, you know, kind of have rocked those rooms, but just through lack of there being space. You know, there's not enough space in the circuit. There's not enough bigger venues hiring comedians now. And I don't think that's to do with there being a free comedy night. I think that's to do with the fact that the entertainment industry is splintered and that there are people now that don't, you know, everyone's obsessed with what's on TV. People go to tours to visit, to see their favourite comedian. They don't go to a comedy club just to see comedy. You know, it's a lot more specific, and the whole media industry has splintered. You know, people very rarely talk about what was on TV last night. They talk about the series that they're watching, you know, and they watch that at their own time and they consume it in their own way, and that's what's different. So the reason why I suppose that bridge between people making money and investing in new talent that comes by is that that's going to happen. People do have money, and, you know, like Netflix or Amazon or the, you know, or Avalon or that have, or Off the Curb, that have money and have talent are going to be able to leverage that. Amazon, you know, Avalon are always going to be able to go to the Pleasants and say, well, listen, if we give you this big act, you've got to put three of our not so big acts on, you know, our new acts in your venue, in the Pleasance Courtyard, which is, you know, one probably the key venue in Edinburgh still in terms of prestige. You know, there's always going to be, that's the, one of the most obvious signs of leverage, but there are so many small signs of leverage, and it's why there's a lot of rubbish on TV, and that's why there's so much bad stuff that made, because there's a lot of leverage, there's a lot of vested interest involved, and that's the world that we live in. But in terms of not being able to change that, we can't change that, but we can be the change we want to see in the world by just giving simply audiences the chance to see new comedians and comedians the chance to perform in front of big audiences. And on a basic level, that's giving people the chance to kind of develop, giving me the chance to develop as a comedian. And I think that's live idea is probably as revolutionary as you get. I don't want to run a production company. I don't want to, you know, I barely want to be a promoter. But if that answers that question, I don't know.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. There's two questions on the back of that. I'm gonna go down the route of three for one more question. Then I'm gonna ask you about the promotion stuff. A lot of clubs talk about the circuit being in crisis, especially in London, and ticket sales being down and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of them put it down to the free open mic gigs ruining that for them or having a massive impact on them. I know you guys have open mic nights. You know, I wouldn't necessarily class you as an open mic club as such, but you have you're obviously a part of that movement that people claim is having an impact on ticket sales in terms of traditional clubs. What would be your response to someone who had that mindset of what you do?
I don't really see how it has had an impact, because I see some incredibly well run ticketed gigs like the Boat Show Comedy Club that don't seem to be struggling at all. Like, so I don't really see that impact.
I see some bad comedy nights that have been running for a long time struggling a lot more for audiences, because people are a lot more kind of discerning about the comedy that they're going to see, and they know what's good and what's not, because television over the last 10 years has shown them what's good comedy and what's not. So they won't go and put up with a bad MC that's just going to insult the audience, and they're not going to put up with a badly run comedy gig. I see that change over the last 10 years. I don't see the change that free comedy is. I think
so,
you know,
there's so many free comedy gigs that don't that aren't well run and that don't survive. It's about quality rather than free, I think.
I think that, again, it's a misnomer. If people are blaming free comedy clubs, it's for a difference in their own product. I don't go to something because... If somebody has money, they don't go to something because it's free or paid. They go to something because it's been recommended. Like, you know, £5 or £10, if you've got £5 or £10, there's not a big reason not to go to a comedy club if it's been recommended to you, or if you trust that it's going to be a good night out. So... the reason why we're successful is because we're good, because we give a shit, because we put a lot of time into thinking about making it good, more time than I'd like. And the other thing, and this is the biggest issue that I have with anyone saying about free comedy clubs running industries, like human beings, I'm really sorry, but our most valuable asset is our time. Time is way more important than money. And if somebody is giving you 2 to 3 hours of their time, like, give them a good show, whether it's free or not. And so the whole idea of people paying or not, it's like, have some respect for humanity, have some respect for people. People are coming out and giving you their night, so don't run a shit night.
It's kind of insulting and a little bewildering to think that people believe that we've gone from 2 nights to 3 nights to 5 nights to 7 nights to now having our own venue just because it's free. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, my sex life would be a lot better on if that was. I have not once charged, and
for sex or for the gig, sorry, just to clarify.
Either. You know, I have a policy and I keep to it.
Okay. Well, no, I mean, when I do new work, when I do a new show, I love doing it on the Free Fringe in Edinburgh and wherever I can do it for free, because A, it means I've got to make it good, because it's not like I've got the money up front. They've not bought a ticket. I mean, when I did my tour, I had to be ticketed at certain venues, but when I can do it free, I like doing it for free, because it means I've got to be on my game, because otherwise they might even not pay for it, and that means I've wasted a year of developing a show, 18 months of getting it sorted and planning out venues, and then my time of getting there. Basically, I've wasted a lot of my life, like you said, with wasting your time. So it's not just respect for them, it's respect for yourself, I think, in terms of just giving them something good. And again, come back to that quality question. I suppose economy wise, it might have helped that there was a, because you started, when did you start? 2009, 2010? 10. Because there's been a banking issue and there's been a recession and stuff in that time, and I suppose that's helped in terms of people have kept their prices for them to try a free night.
I think that's overthinking it. I think a good night runs by reputation. It doesn't run because it's free. I mean, maybe that's true, and I'm sure there are many, many reasons why different clubs succeed and fail, and there'll be many people listening to this that disagree with my opinion about, you know, people's time being more valuable than money, and, you know, I think that's just respect for human beings, but other people have different ways of perceiving the world, you know, but I think that you can overthink these things, and ultimately we care about the comedy, and we care about putting on a good night, and we care about bringing new acts in, because that's who we are, you know. And it's an intelligent self-interest. We're interested in creating a circuit that I'm interested in creating a circuit that I can thrive and perform in, and running a free comedy night means I get to experiment, I get to do interesting stuff, I get to kind of, you know, perform in front of an audience regularly. And if I had to rely on other people's booking me, I mean, I would get booked, but I wouldn't get booked as regularly. And I don't know, I just want to perform. I know it sounds very kind of Kids from Fame, but it's like, I don't want to live forever, but next year will be nice. But other than that, but yeah. So.
Well, I was gonna talk about the fact that you were saying you don't really want to be seen as a promoter and your label change. So I'm pointing at you and audio doesn't pick it up. Barry saying that he doesn't necessarily want to be called a promoter or labelled that way. And Sarah saying that your label has changed, that you are now full-time as a promoter, in fact, a director of a comedy night. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I go with the Fight Club ad is that you're not your job. You're not defined by one action. You're not defined by a simple thing. But I know in terms of, especially the entertainment industry, you can get very tarred with a brush very quickly, especially with like acting or something. You get typecast and it's, you're stuck with it. How has being a promoter, as it's evolved, changed you as a person and impacted you as either being a comedian or not being a comedian?
Good question. How has being a promoter impacted my life? Oh, I like that. Okay. Well, so I started out performing, so with very similar motivations to Barry. And I just, after a few years, I found the performing too hard. It's hard, Barry. I don't know why you do it. It's hard.
Listen, I've got more deep-seated emotional reasons to do it. Or problems to do it.
And I just found myself that I was enjoying running the nights, and any time that we'd overbooked or I didn't have to perform, I was like, yes, I get to have a drink and just hang out with my friends.
A good year of conversations of like, Sarah, you're really good. We need you to open. We need you to do this. But that person can open. No, they can't. We need you to open. It's like, but do I have to? Yes, you bloody have.
After
to.
About a year of that, of kind of Barry spending most of the nights trying to convince me to perform, perhaps I decided that comedy wasn't for me. Performing comedy. So I just started. Yeah, I guess I was a casual promoter, just in terms of running those nights and caring about them and loving them and hanging out with people I loved and having a really good night. Now that we've got the venue, I'd say that it's more a job that I still love, but we're still figuring things out. I don't know whether I call myself a promoter, because like this place is a lot more than that. It's about 10 years ago, I used to, God, no, 15 years ago. How old am I? I don't know. Back in Sheffield, I'm talking about a long time ago. It's 10 years ago. I ran a circus arts charity and a theatre company charity kind of thing. So I was always really into kind of community arts. So now with this venue, this is what I see this becoming in the stand-up world. So there's I'm still not a promoter, I'd say. I don't think I'd class myself as that. Certainly when we launch, some of my job is going to be trying to get information about the nights and stuff out there, but kind of looking at this as a whole and kind of what it could do and developing different relationships with different organizations and building a comedy community in this venue hub. Like, I don't know whether that does have a kind of job title, because maybe I don't think it's been done before. Yeah,
not in the UK at least.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes in terms of how it impacts me. I'm still very happy that I'm continuing the psychotherapy training, because it means that I have a million therapists to support me in this. Not a million, like 10.
More than most.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. It's just like free therapy with all my peers. So that's really good, because it turns out getting your own venue is a lot of work, Simon. I don't know.
I wouldn't know, but
yeah.
It looks it.
Who knew that?
Everyone knew that. Everyone knew that. It was apparently, except for you two.
Yep. Barry has nothing to add to that. He's just rocking gently in the corner.
Yeah. You took me to a bad place. What was the question again?
The question was, how has being a promoter affected you as a person / performer / anything else that it might have affected?
I'm an accidental promoter. I don't really promote. I just, like, to be honest, a lot of the reason why Angel Comedy works is because it's a good night and I try and make it as good as possible, and people come back and people enjoy it, and that's the best type of promotion you get. The best
word
type of promotion
mouth.
You get is word of mouth. It's one of the things I find most tedious of people calling me, like in my last Chortle review, the review spent 3 paragraphs saying what a great promoter I was, and it's, you know, by way of kind of diminishing the show, of kind of saying there are loads of people here. It's not because of the show, it's because he's a good promoter. And what it missed was the amount of love and care that went into promoting the show and like having fun with the advertising of it. And also it was good, so people came back and went other places. Like, people seem to see promotion as something different to, like, the best promotion is just being good. It's like, why does everybody like that person? Because they're nice. Not because they're really good at Facebook updates. You know, you might follow them, but you kind of don't necessarily want to hang out and have a drink. And that's not saying that I'm the most amazing performer or person in the world, but I've always just concentrated on trying to be as funny as possible and trying to give the audience, respect the audience as much as possible and make the night as good as possible. And that has resulted in the club being good. And because I care and I don't want to let people down. And hopefully I'm not quite as mental enough to it means I can maybe, I don't know, I went off piste in that last, I don't know where I was going about mental. I looked Sarah in the eye and she just went, no, what? You're mental. Yeah. We've discussed this.
Remember, you're the mental one. I'm the one that's trying to find a way of dealing with it.
You're the Kramer. So yeah, I don't really see myself as a promoter, and I know a lot of other people do. I think the main way that's changed my life is that a lot of new acts don't tell me the truth. That's not true. They just, you know, they treat me with a kind of, like, they're a bit more wary around me because they think it's going to change the way that I see them or whatever. But I'm not looking at like that really, but I think I can definitely see the difference between the way that they respond to me. Like, somebody might be quite rude to somebody else around me, and they'll be so super nice to me, and I see that quite a lot. And that's fine. It's just it's that, so people are nicer to me, I can't complain, but it's people see me as more important than I am, and all I am really is a comedian that runs a night. So, but that's nice. I mean, I suppose it's a reputation of Angel or the reputation of me running Angel, but that's probably the only way that's changed my life, other than, yeah.
I took a girl to a gig one time just after I started, and I didn't like it because we broke up, and then when I went back to that gig I had the association of her being there, and I thought, I'll never take a girl to a gig ever again. I said, no, I've got problems, but I thought, I'll never take a girl to a gig ever again. And then it took a year or so for me to take another one back, and I remember that one, it didn't work out either, but because I did establish myself a bit more by that point, it was a different night, people were coming over, and immediately when they found out she wasn't in comedy, I'd watch how they'd react to her rather than me, because I sort of didn't like that they would go, oh, she doesn't run a gig, or she's not really in it, so why do they matter in a way? And it's kind of like that, where it's like, they still matter, they're still a person, and they're going to be watching you and judging you in about 10 minutes, so maybe don't treat them like crap. But I suppose, I mean, I don't really see many people treating people like crap at the night anyway, but I suppose you're looking at, you've got a different perspective on the night than I do.
Yeah, and a lot of new acts come through the club, which is just a lot of people.
And the majority of them, a lot of audience members as well.
Majority lovely.
Yeah,
everyone's lovely, isn't it?
I mean, thinking about audience members, like, maybe we get one or two a week who are a bit dickish, but considering the
not
amount of people,
that, once, not yet, once a month, yeah.
And like, when that happens, we're so like devastated and like, oh, why is the world, you know, why is the world so bad? But actually, the perspective of you know, thinking how many people are actually not even just dicks, but lovely, and that's my experience. Of comedians as well, like, there are so many of you that it's bound, I'm sure there are a couple of dicks,
but
it's weird that the majority aren't quite cool. Or maybe, I don't know,
Sunil Patel's a dick.
Yeah, it's true,
he's a total dick. Like, don't if you see Sunil Patel and he's got this kind of like cuddly kind of Persian cat kind of thing to him, you want to give him a hug or something like that, don't. He'll take your wallet.
Am I leaving that in?
Yeah, you're definitely leaving that in, because I want to warn people about Sunil Patel. Seriously.
Oh, this is a sincere thing. This isn't you've got a joke going and this is you adding in. No, do you know what I mean? Like,
it's totally true. Yeah, 100% true. Sunil Patel.
Yeah, just don't trust him.
Don't trust him.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. I was going to say, because the only trying to move on slightly, but it's not working. The only time I've had a bad experience at your night was when there was a guy yelling stuff out, and you literally picked him up and carried him out.
Yeah.
Because he was yelling stuff out for every act, and by the end of about halfway through my set, I just said, "Look, just shut up." And then he yelled out, "Trump sucks."
Oh,
and
at that point,
you came over and just went, "We're picking you up," like, literally, and you walked him out.
I said, "Come on, go out." He was drunk, and I was like, "Come on, you're out. Come on, I've warned you once." And And he said, no, I'm not moving. So I literally scooped him up out of the chair and carried him out. And outside he was like, all right, and well, sorry about that, and then left.
Yeah.
But I think...
It was amazing. I left stage after. I had 5 minutes left and I left stage because I thought, I'm never going to be able to top that. That was such a great moment that everyone was cheering and laughing.
The first time my parents ever came to Angel...
Well, what happened?
I think you were up in Edinburgh. Oh. And there were like these three massive lads like at the back just heckling people, which never happens at Angel. And I, in front of my parents, I had to remove them. It was so weird. I had to try and say, this doesn't happen all the time, because I think they were a bit worried for my safety. But I did it like a pro, got them out.
Yeah, got it.
A lot of comedians start nights to trade spots, essentially, when they first start out, because it's a lot easier to, if you've got a commodity to play with there. Did that ever come into account? Have you ever lost gigs as a result of being promoters when you were gigging or now? Or have you ever found that because you wouldn't trade spots, you lost out on nights or anything like that?
So for me, when I was performing, it made it made it harder for me to want to perform elsewhere, because like they all, I got used to Angel. I got used to performing in the Camden Head. Angel, and I got used to that room, so everywhere else felt really difficult. But I never, yeah, so that's one of my memories from back then in terms of other gigs and there. But I never really got into the whole tit for tat swapping thing.
Yeah, I generally, if somebody's nice and they want to come and perform, they can come perform, and then if they're nice, they'll give you a reciprocal gig.
I think
initially, maybe in the first 6 months, because I was running the new act nights myself, like the booking side of it, then I think there was some reciprocalness in the first kind of couple of years. But again, it's just if somebody's nice and they can come perform anyway. But yeah, so that, you know, I think again, it's all about performing. It's like that's opens your opportunities to perform. So yeah, absolutely. But it's not solely that. It's more of a rare case that somebody else is running a night anyway. That's nice, but it's always good to play other places.
I have questions I normally ask promoters, but they don't feel as applicable based on what you've just said. So they're things like, were there be any reasons why you would blacklist a comedian, or why you would not book them? And it feels like it's just going to be just because they're not nice, or because they're doing offensive material that would ruin them.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Room or sorry, what you
know? I'm just thinking of the people that have done offensive material.
all that, and Sunil Patel, obviously.
Yeah. If they're Sunil Patel,
yeah,
or doing a Sunil Patel tribute act.
That's another reason we'd blacklist.
I'll change what I do next week, but it's
Nick Heller is a dick too. Could this just be that's what the podcast is? Just kind of like being.
It will go viral if you mention about four more names. I'm just saying. by the way, your face just went, oh, can I drop in?
Oh, there's plenty of people.
But it's. I mean, do people know they're not allowed back then? Like, if would you email someone and say, or would you just never reply? What would be your protocol for that?
Usually people that don't gig, or you don't want at your gig are not very nice people. So you kind of, you don't really have to say anything, because they, you know, they ask, you can just kind of say, you're not really quite right. So yeah, I mean, the Angel Comedy Club has a certain demographic of people that come and watch it. You know, if you're going to come on stage, there was a comedian that came on once, and he's a good comedian and played lots of clubs and had a successful podcast, but he threatened a woman on the front row that he was going to...
I thought you were talking about me for a second. I was like, I've never threatened a woman ever, let alone on the front row.
He threatened to cut her face off.
Oh my God.
And fuck her eye socket, I think is the thing. And, you know, he's a good performer and there's an audience for what he does, but that woman left crying and she didn't get that it was a joke, and she was on the front row and her and her friend were upset by it, and it wasn't really done in jest. It was done quite, you know, the funniness was how angry he was saying it. And so I think, and I don't believe in saying that anything isn't necessarily funny. I think there are subjects, every subject you can make funny. It's like, you know, people say, oh, you can never make a rape joke. And Bridget Christie has some amazing rape jokes. You know, there's like, you know, some women, like one of her brilliant ones, you know, some women have rape fantasies. Well, I have a rape fantasy, which is a, you know, proper judicial system that deals with rapists fairly. Like, that's my rape fantasy. That's a rape joke. Mm. And that's brilliant. But it's, so, like, every subject can be spoken about, but it's just, you don't be horrible to people and respect people, and that, both in the audience and that aren't there.
Yeah.
And over the past few years, again, considering the amount of comedians who have come through our doors, I can think of maybe two or three.
No, you've not been at enough open mic nights. There are more. You can think of people on a Saturday night. No, seriously.
Yeah. Right. But. Okay, but a surprisingly few number of people that we've kind of the kind of people that we would think we're never gonna book back. Like, generally we have really open policy, and the only reason that people don't get as many gigs as perhaps they'd like is because
we try and get everyone in.
We try and literally get everybody
and
in.
We don't blacklist people.
Yeah,
there is no such thing as a blacklist.
That's
because
what
people
I'm
change.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, it just because somebody does the cutting your face off eye socket thing, who's a person, lovely guy off stage, it's baffling why he's like that on stage.
Yeah,
but it, you know, that's, everyone's got their own style. But even that guy, if he emails a year and a half later and we have a conversation about, listen, you can't go quite as dark because you really hurt somebody last time, and he goes, oh, I get that, then there's no such thing as a blacklist.
Exactly. We'd give them another chance. It's all about being open. I think people imagine that we do only have this very severe booking policy, and it's not the case.
No, it's just we try and give as much to stage time to as many people as possible, which means that we can't get people in as regularly as we like.
Because there's a lot of you.
There's a lot of amazing people. That's the thing that's mental. There are so many fucking awesome acts out there, and so few of them are represented because they don't fit into a certain demographic. It's heartbreaking because so many of them will give up. Like, the amount of people that have given up that are brilliant.
Like me.
Like you. Like, you know, like, you know, that are getting regular spots. Like, so, you know, I don't want to name them, because if I name them, then, you know, but...
If you name three, you name 20. And,
yeah, precisely. But there are literally, like, boundary-changing, fascinating, brilliant acts. And you know exactly who I'm talking about. The people that can alchemize a room, change a room, make people feel like special that they've at that gig. And those people are not picked up because they're not as consistent, or they can't fit into a little box that somebody has, or they haven't won an award and been different. Or, you know, for every John Kearns, there's 20 other people that are as different or as good and yet didn't quite kind of have the circumstances around which that allowed them to be that successful. And
what I love about running a night, though, is that for that moment, we give audience members the chance to experience those acts that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So variety, true variety.
Yes, yeah. And that specialness. So, I mean, I guess I'm relating to an earlier question that you had about kind of the industry and going further and what success is. But, you know, for those moments, there's success and there's specialness.
I find it hard to ask you guys questions because you are like we talked. You are Sunil Patel in person. I'm gonna have to edit that out.
The world has to know.
I don't know why he's never been a dick to me, so yeah. No.
You're lucky, Simon.
It's only a matter of time.
Well, so, I've only met him twice, three
yeah,
times.
Yeah, you would have been a dick behind your back.
All right, fair enough.
You know.
Well, I don't know. The problem I've got is unless someone is a dick directly at me, right, I just assume they're probably quite nice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Terrible.
And I'm aware.
Naive.
I'm aware that all I'm asking for there is for people to DM me on Twitter and Facebook and go, you're a fucking arsehole. I can't believe you didn't ask my question or whatever. But, whatever. Yeah, go on.
No, that's not.
Yeah, you were going to say something.
No, I was just saying.
What was your question?
Oh, my thing was that most of the time when I interview promoters, the questions are very much because they're a cog in a machine of the industry, if that makes sense. So if an act's owned by Avalon, let's go with that for now, wanted to get themselves on the Amuse Moose, they would obviously have that connection and they would go, well, we're going to get this act on who's massive. You need to book, like you said, three of our other acts on in the preceding weekends because otherwise we won't let you have whoever it may be, Dara O'Brien, whoever it was, right? Whereas you guys aren't, you're part of that system, but you're not in that system. It doesn't feel like you're... I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but I feel like you know what I'm trying to say, but I'm not saying it very well.
There's a great philosopher, social philosopher, partially great, called Hakim Bey, who talks a lot about mediation and how so much of the alienation in our society is created by how many media or how many kind of different connections our connection with a human being has to go through. So like an experience of watching TV is a really mediated experience, so that while you can watch TV and empathize or a movie or empathize with somebody, there are so many layers that it goes through. It goes through the projector, it goes through the director's eye, the editor's eye. There are so many different ways and filters which it goes through. And the live experience of having somebody on stage with a microphone is one of the least mediated experiences you can have. It is mediated through the PA, you know, so you can reach more people. But a live experience in a small room, the fewer people in that room to a certain degree, the less mediated that experience. And talking to somebody person in person is the least mediated of all. It's still mediated by language. It's still mediated by how much I can express by flapping my meat at you. You know, it's those kind of things. And what the reason why I'm bringing that up is because what I find value in and what Angel Comedy is it's about creating an unmediated or as little mediated experience as possible for both the audience and the performer in a room, in a live moment where they can share a moment in a room with a performer that is real. And that for me is where stand-up is. It's where a stand-up loses a lot of its value after you get to rooms of more than 1,000 people. It's why it's special with rooms of say 60 to 1,000 people in different ways. Different rooms have different kind of strengths, whatever. But it's one of the most valuable and important things in our society that you actually have contact and connection with not only other performers, but also other audience members. And it's something that grows community, and it's something, but it's also something really importantly that you cannot make a huge amount of money on. Its value is inherent in its actual operation, and so you can't capitalize on it and make too much money unless you're charging £60 a ticket. And I suppose the experience that we've had running, because we run a comedy club for ourselves as stand-up comedians, is we have tripped upon and found luckily this kind of format or formula for creating something special that means something to both the performer and the audience in the room. And I think that's outside of most people's concept of what reality is, because most people's concept of reality is to do with making money and how do you fit into that cog and how do you fit into that machine. And we're not in a machine. We are in the human world of relating from one human to another and creating possibilities for that to happen.
That's deep, man.
Yeah. Can I ask for context just before I reply to what you just said? You both have, you're a student, Sarah, at the moment.
Yeah.
And you have a job is my point to that.
I now live off comedy, so I now do corporates, okay. And I also perform at various other big clubs that pay me big money, man, cash pussy money.
Big fat comedy dollar.
Sorry, I was really struck by what you were saying there, Barry. I think that sums up a lot for me, kind of what Angel is about, and also why my other passion is psychotherapy, because it's about connection and that one-on-one thing is what I get. Like, I was hungry, Angel gave me a taste and I wanted more. To go back to what you were saying about, like, it's almost like if we had an agenda to invite agent to come and see acts, like that would change the change the essence of what we were doing, the simplicity, the purity of it. God, I'm sounding like a bit pretentious now. But
I say fuck pretension, because pretension is just what
how cynics, someone perceives it.
No, but pretension is the word that cynics put on somebody actually expressing themselves honestly. And like, I love Josie Long's line of like, what's the value in being cynical in the world? Like, you get to the end of your life and you know what? I didn't enjoy any of it. Get me now. It's just a lack of not being vulnerable. You know, is
And we were talking before mics about personal issues and connection. And I've spent a lot of time in the last year struggling to talk to new people and have relationships, because I've been questioning whether you can ever know anyone, whether the filters that people build up and the media they take in and the fact that I can only perceive a small amount of what they are because of the way they're expressing themselves to me and my filter on what I receive from that. I'm not sure. So the fact that you have that, but from a larger point of view of what you're doing here is amazing to me, because I often don't feel like you can ever fully know anyone unless you were that person.
Yeah, there's a great book called Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is, I recommend anyone read. It's about his time in the concentration camps in Auschwitz. And it's like, whatever has meaning for you has meaning for you in that moment. And connection is about finding meaning in connection with other people.
Sitting there analysing us both, looking at the floor going, I wish I had my notepad. I'd make a bloody fortune.
But it's where I agree you can't truly know what it's like to be another person. Mm. But where the magic happens is where these two separate people, whether that's a therapist and a client, or two friends, or two strangers, or an audience and a comedian. Where the magic happens is where these two separate people meet, and that's what the connection is, and that's where it gets magic.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. It's a vulnerable state to be in.
It's terrifying.
From an audience member, which is why I was thinking about this the other day. Why no one ever sits in the front row? They're perceiving that as the most vulnerable, because they're in the line of fire to be vulnerable with someone who's put themselves in a position to be vulnerable in front of them.
It's terrifying for comedians, it's terrifying for audience members, it's terrifying for psychotherapists and for clients and for two strangers who meet each other for the first time. Like, actually meeting each other in their truth and their vulnerability is really scary, and there's a lot of risk, but there's also a lot of payoff.
You can definitely listen to Brené Brown on TED Talk, and I mean, I'd absolutely echo what Sarah said. And I also think that I think the idea of self is really, you know, we live in a society that really heightens the notion of the individual. You look at any, like, the height of what you can do in this world, and it drives consumerism, and everything that's capitalism is to find your unique talent and express that within the world. And I just think that's, to be honest, it's like our own conceptions of who we are just our beliefs. They're just who we think we are. And who we think we are is like, it's beside the point. Who we are is right now.
And that's the thing that we all strive for, to find our unique talent, to express that, and to make a lot of money from it. And actually, I guess what we've been talking about is very different.
If you remove the money element of something, would you still do it? Is the question that I like asking people, especially in comedy at the moment. And a lot of
we did.
But a lot of performers, you know, like you said, their main aim is to get on TV or to get a lot of money out of it and that kind of stuff. And I'm, oddly enough, reluctantly enjoying my day job at the moment, because as much as I'm doing better than I've ever done on stand-up, and I'm getting booked in more places than I've ever been, I wouldn't at the moment want to make it my full-time thing. If someone turned around to me tomorrow and said, we'll pick you up as an agent or make it your full-time thing, I'd have to really consider it. But at the moment, I'm liking that it's not, because it means that when I pick the gigs I'm doing, which I can do at this stage because I have the luxury of the fact I have a day job, it means that I enjoy what I'm doing a lot more. And I'm hoping to follow that through, but I don't know if that'll work as a, because we all do stuff we're not happy with doing just because we need money as well.
Exactly. And I do understand that, you know, of course we've all got to pay bills, so there's no judgment on those kind of questions, like, which is a bit disingenuous, because I feel like we have been judging a little bit, haven't we?
Who have we been judging apart from Sunil?
Mainly Sunil. Money,
you're giving
grabbing.
Him a lot of airplay for someone
well,
you don't
I
like.
The thing is, though, I mean, you say we've been judging, like, you know, we all live our life by our set of beliefs, and at the moment, the social system that we live in believes that money is the most important thing that you need. It's like, you know, we're all dancing to that drum, and that's very out there, and you can't swim against the tide. It's very difficult to even ideologically within your own head swim against that tide. So, and you know, we're manipulated to swim against that tide, but not in a kind of conspiracy theory way. It's just the way that that society works. And but I suppose the reason I'm saying that is because I think that a lot of people that look at Angel are seeing it through the prism of money and the money machine. And that's fine, and it is part of, you know, part of the world, and you do have to survive, and that's really, you know, pragmatic. And I guess I've never been pragmatic. I'm somebody that, you know, that has never been pragmatic. I'm a professional idiot as a job, you know. So
Well, I had a couple of questions on community, because
it's a good sitcom.
It's more specifically your community.
Okay.
What were the milestones? First of all, you started as an open mic thing, and most people start open mic things literally, like you said, for stage time. But it feels like you branched off in a different way to most open mics, where their main focus is just getting people in the door every week, and it's not building a relationship with them. It's not building that community feel to mean they would tell their friends, and then their friends would come, and maybe they'd come with, or they'd come back another week. Was that a conscious effort on your part, or did that organically come out of this ethos that you've been talking about? And what were the milestones involved in making that community continue to grow?
I mean, I think it was organic. With a lot of work, but
I think it was organic. People one of the things that came up for me in that question is, like, a lot of people like to ascribe kind of pride or intentionality to what happens in their life, and I think that anyone is who is in any place is so there by luck or chance. About, you know, it's like where you were born, what you ended up doing, where the open mic gig you started running was, you know, there is so much luck and opportunity. You know, you can't, there wasn't an intention to create a community, wasn't an intention to do anything else other than to get stage time, and it was just lucky, really. And I think luck is 90% of it. You know, it's like, yeah, you've got to then use that 10% if you've got for marginal gains and try and make it work. But, and if you haven't got something good, and so the meaning didn't kind of drive it. The meaning is kind of like, you know, I try and be a good person. I fail a lot of the time, but yeah.
I remember it really surprised me when I started hearing about Angel comedy being talked about outside of our circle.
Yeah, it still surprises me when people see it outside
of, it's really weird. I was like, oh, you got, like, a friend of mine was saying, oh yeah, my work colleagues like love Angel. And I was how did they know? So that kind of surprise tells me that perhaps I'm not the most intentional of promoters. But yeah.
Okay.
Organic is the answer to the question.
I'm not going to bother answering the follow-up then, because it's pretty much answered by that. I'm going to ask you the quick-fire finishing questions. Quick-fire for me, you take as long as you like. First of all, aside from the one you've already recommended, are there any books that you would recommend on stand-up comedy, radio, writing, any of that kind of stuff?
I feel a bit on the spot. I feel like I haven't read anything ever in my life now.
What, comedy-wise, or ever?
Ever. I did an English lit degree first. I can't remember a single book. I've been getting really into David Sedaris recently after you gave Masood that book.
Yeah, Naked's a good book. I think that if you've got the drive to be funny, you will be funny, and just read as much, as broad a broader section, cross-section of things, and be interested in as many things as possible. Like, that's as best you can do, and then have it filtered through your own sense of humour, and apply yourself. Just sit down and do it, and don't doubt yourself, for Christ's sake. Like, everyone can fucking do it. Like, if I can do it, anyone can fucking do it. I'm an idiot.
And you definitely will doubt yourself.
Yeah, and that's because you will.
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the comedy industry?
Sunil Patel. He's fucking awesome. He's one of my favourite acts.
Change your tune like an iPod shuffle there. Like,
I'm the Schrodinger's cat. He's the Schrodinger's cat comedian. You never know how you're going to feel about him until you get him out of the box. Underrated person in person.
It can either be, well, I always keep it vague, so it can either be an industry person or a comedian, however you want to do it.
Barry.
Sarah. not me, Barry.
Oh, yeah.
Barry Cryer.
Barry Cryer, yeah.
Another lonely Barry.
I think the most underrated person is probably somebody that we don't know. Like, if they're rated, you kind of know who they are. I mean, you know, there are people that do great work. I mean, what I find interesting is those people like Bob Slayer, who's a really good self-publicist, but also I know certain things about Bob's personal life, and I know that he's actually a really good person, despite how he might appear sometimes. Like, you know...
He's a lovely guy.
Yeah, yeah. And genuinely, but he wouldn't publicise those things. There are certain people that I know that are really well-known, and I'm not going to name drop, but some of the things that I know that they've done have been stunningly moving and supportive of those people around them. I suppose I don't know, I think there are a lot of people that do a lot of good things that we don't hear about.
I thought about something else, actually. MCs, I think, are really underrated.
So, good MCs.
Yeah. The ability to MC is, like, we still have audience members coming out and saying, and, you know, saying to the MCs, oh, you should give stand-up a go.
Nobody ever says that to me.
If anything, they say, maybe don't bother next time.
No, they just say, just keep emceeing. You don't worry about doing it.
But yeah, like MCs, I think, are underrated. Okay. Really good ones.
What do you think is the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Sunil Patel. Yeah. How would you solve him? Yeah.
I don't know.
He's going to say cut his face off. He's going to fuck his iPod.
What happened if you shaved him?
Could
your final question always involve you asking somebody, what do you think of Sunil Patel?
I can add it in if you want. When I asked, Beck Hill submitted a question to Karen.
She's another dick.
I'll agree with that. She is totally the worst.
Isn't she?
No, she submitted a question to Karen Corrin. That was, who is your favourite comedian named Beck Hill? which I thought was a great starting question. So if you want, I can always ask, who is your least favourite comedian called Sunil Patel?
Biggest problem in the comedy industry?
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think things, you can get quite, you know, our human brains really like to make things black and white. And, you know, it's very efficient, evolutionarily, it's really efficient. It saves us energy and saves us time to be able to know one thing and know that's a problem. And I don't really like thinking in modular terms in that sense. I mean, I don't know if Daniel Kitson still thinks this way, but one of my favourite lines from Daniel Kitson is, if I come to a conclusion about something, it just means I stop thinking about it, which I really like as a notion in which to live your world, because, you know, truth is impermanent. There's no such thing as absolute truth.
Buddhism.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's Buddhism, but it's also, you know, it's relativism, it's postmodernism, underscores a lot of other communities, a lot of other philosophies. But my point being is, like, what is the biggest problem in the comedy industry? I think there is no problem in the comedy industry. I think the comedy industry is a beautiful, amazing thing.
It just is.
And it just is. And that. I think there might be a lot of problems for certain people in the comedy industry if they're trying to earn a shit ton of money, or if they're not famous enough, or if they're not getting, you know, booked up because they're too old or too generic, or however they see other people and how relative they see themselves to the rest of the. So a problem is only a problem from the point of view of the person that's kind of looking at it. Like, a problem for one person is a solution for somebody else. You know, like you say, oh, Avalon are a massive problem for people in the comedy industry.
But
you might say Avalon, yeah, because they're such a big agency. But Matt Ford would tell you that Avalon are a big problem in the comedy industry because he's just got a series. So, like, a problem is only a problem for where you are standing. And to be honest, where I'm standing is I'm much more interested in looking at, if I can, at what are the good things, because I find that if I think of the good things, then that engenders more good things, rather than if I think of the problems, I see 1,000 problems. So I'm going all kind of like, I don't know, Deepak Chopra on you, sorry.
Short answer, Sunil Patel, okay.
That's what Sunil would say, but he'd do it in his voice, you know, like a real wanky voice.
Such a dick.
he doesn't talk like that normally. If you turn him off stage, just sounds like a squeaky man from Helium Fashion. Horrible. I'm just joining in now and I like him, but I literally don't know what side you guys are on.
I like confusing Simon.
Yeah.
It's not fun for me. By the way, the only reason I said Buddhism is because we've talked about that off mic before in terms of you when you went to Hawaii and a retreat and meditation based
stuff. Yeah, that wasn't a Buddhism, that was a Hindu.
Oh, my bad.
So, but no,
I know it's present in a lot of different philosophies and a lot of different religions, but I know impermanence from Buddhism, that's why.
Yeah, I don't ascribe to any particular religion. I think that a belief structure is really interesting in how people act on their beliefs. But I also think that belief is malleable and it's really interesting if you kind of... Yeah, and go, I believe in this today and I believe in that tomorrow.
Yeah.
I love how philosophical and like spiritual this podcast has got.
It doesn't normally.
It's great.
This is what it usually is.
I love
just
it.
Me and him chatting, that's what happens. Well, no, like I would not say I am any religion. I'd say there's no God, that's as far as I'd go, but I wouldn't say I have.
Say there's no God?
Yeah. I don't believe
what do you think it was God, though? Then you're defining what you think it was
God.
Oh,
yeah, that's a problem. So I don't believe in the whole there is a higher power in any kind of...
Are you not a higher power?
I'm not going to say that. I'm all right. No, I just, in the traditional sense of what
How
God is...
How many downloads does this have? You told me you're a higher power, so...
I told you it
are
does...
Are you a lower power? It, what kind of power are you?
This episode is not going to do very well, I'll tell you that much. in the traditional sense of what God is defined as, in other words, an omnipotent being who created everything and knows everything and is everywhere. I don't believe in that. I do believe in matter and energy and the way that that's perceived is not necessarily the way that I would completely ascribe to it, but I don't have a religion. So
I love this. It's turned into us interviewing Simon about his beliefs. I want that to continue.
Yeah.
But I think we've got a comedy night tomorrow.
Yeah, I've got a comedy night. So we'll end on this question. I had two, but I'll end on this one. I'll ask it, and if you've got a quick answer, then we'll do that. The question was going to be, what is the biggest misconception about who you are or what you do, and what would be your response to it?
I don't know that people know who I am, really.
I know who you are. You two do,
but like
that's
I don't.
Neil acts like he doesn't know you.
Just blanks me all
the time. It's all that matters that we know.
But I mean, kind of industry level, like. So I don't know whether people think, oh, that's Sarah.
No one cares.
Nobody knows how they're perceived.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Okay, so your biggest misconception is you don't know if you're even being perceived.
Exactly. And then I'm okay with that.
Okay, and...
I know, read all my Chortle reviews, come to your own conclusion. you'll see how I'm perceived, because that's, yeah.
Okay, the last question is going to be, what is the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And if you had one bit of advice for a comedian wanting to start their own comedy night now, what would it be?
I remember the best bit of advice I was given when I was starting out comedy was by Paul McCaffrey. He was doing the gig of my first gig, and he said, there are going to be some nights that you're going to want to give up, and there are going to be some nights that you do so well that you want to, you think you're going to be in Jonathan Ross show the next day, and it's about keeping level and that was the best advice I had. But then I quit 3 years later, so maybe it was shit advice, Paul. Thanks, Paul.
There's the Jonathan Ross show side of things. It was around the time that Jonathan Ross show was cancelled, actually.
What does Paul know? Paul's worse than Sonno. My God.
The question was biggest bit of advice.
The best bit of advice you've ever been given. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a bit of advice you've ever used, because a lot of people go, that's a great bit of advice, I never fucking use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what would be one bit of advice you would have for someone who wants to start their own comedy night now?
I don't know whether I've been given any advice. It's funny, when you're a new comedian, you ask everyone, oh, what do you think about this? Did that go? You know, you're seeking advice, and really, the only thing you can do is write and take risks on stage and fail and get up and fail again, fail better, you know, as Samuel Beckett said. But I think people are often looking for a larger solution or a larger end game, like that's where I want to end up, and ultimately all you've got is this particular moment right now. And are you doing what you want to do in this moment? Are you doing everything you can? And if you are writing comedy or performing comedy, you've got that happening in your life, then you're fucking making it. You're doing exactly what you want to do. So maybe don't end game it or disrespect where you are right now and just go, right, this is awesome where I am right now. I get to perform, I get to write, I get to express myself, and, you know, and yeah, I can have in my head that I might like to get on TV or I might like to meet these people and write with those people. But there's something very special. We're very lucky, I think, in the West, and very lucky in the time that we're born to be able to actually write things and to be able to perform them and express ourselves creatively. And that's not been something that's been possible before, so I guess just appreciate where you are.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Simon.
That was Barry and Sarah. There's a real, and I don't want to get too Jurassic Park on you, but anyone who knows me even vaguely well will know that I can't go more than 12 hours without referencing that film. But there's a real life finds a way element to the way they talk, and I found that just inspiring and interesting and just amazingly, although they were clearly tense and stressed about all the work that they've taken on to make that project that they've worked so hard on to become a success, there's a real optimism in their voice, and I just really enjoyed the edit of it. I personally believe time is the most valuable thing we have, and it should be much higher up the chain than money than it already is to some people. And their ethos and my ethos about doing comedy and doing stand-up for the performance and for the right reasons, or for the reasons that we think are right, really, it was just great to have a like-minded conversation about that, and to play devil's advocate for people who are maybe cynically looking at the way the free model works in London, or even the free model in general. So I really enjoyed that. I should point out that free is not the only option. And it shouldn't be the only option. It's just one that happens to have worked for them, but it happens to have worked for them because they've built this community and they've invested in people and they've put their time into something that they can be proud of at the end of the day. I want to thank them for giving me the time to talk to me and to take part in this project. As I said, time is the most valuable thing we have, so the fact they gave me a few hours of theirs is amazing, especially at a time where they were still building and constructing the venue and putting it all into place for the big launch that happened a few weeks ago. If you'd like to thank them, you can find their social media links in the show notes or on the website, or if you just Google Angel Comedy or the Bill Murray on or the Bill Murray Pub, probably was what to Google better. Best name for a pub ever, by the way. Love that name. If you Google any of those things, you should be able to find them, and you can just send them a thank you. Please do take a moment to do that if you've got any value out of this podcast, because it's important to do that. That goes for all the guests, by the way. If you've got value out of any of these podcasts, send me something if you want to. That's great. But if you are sending me something saying, I really love this guest, please also send it to the guest. I pass it on most of the time, and it's amazing when that happens. It happens maybe once every couple of days, and I love it. But it's a case of please do tell the guests as well, because it's important that they know that people are valuing what they're doing and their contribution to this project as well. Personal highlight of this for me was the speech Barry gave at about the 40-minute mark. It was just an honour to edit that and to listen to it over and over and over and over and over again. Just neither of them were aware of the questions ahead of time, as always, and so their answers were off the cuff. And a lot of the things he said were just things I've always wanted to say, but in a much more succinct way. And so it was just great to have that. I might even just clip it and put it somewhere so people can listen to just that if they want to, because it was just great and well said. So kudos, Barry, if you're still listening to this. Kudos. Also, why are you listening to your own podcast? Find that weird, don't you? As I mentioned at the start, my new concept night is going to be taking place at the Bill Murray in Islington in London. It's an LGBT and kink themed comedy night, and I'm really excited. I'm doing this with a friend of mine who is not a comedian but is in the comedy industry, who has got a lot of experience in booking nights and sorting out the marketing for them. And yeah, we're both just very excited about the project and the way that it's moving. And it's on the 22nd of January. You can still buy a ticket. It's in the show notes and on my website and on the website for the podcast. Just everywhere. Just look up Queer as Jokes. That's the name of the night. It will be the name of the podcast when I manage to get that off the ground. It's just slightly delayed because of the amount of other commitments I've got. If you can't make it, please do share the link with someone who you think can. Also, if you'd like to learn more about the free economy and how to build an audience around what you do, my book is on sale. Cheap plug here, but it's great segue, Simon. Solid segueing. Don't know why the BBC haven't rung me yet to ask you to do some voiceover work. My second book, How to Make a Living by Working for Free, is now available on Amazon Kindle for £5, or you can buy it in a paperback Slack format on my website, which is simonkane.co.uk/shop. You can find those links in the show notes for this podcast, also on my website. Any and all support in that area would be amazing. That book is a how-to guide for artists on how to build an audience for what they do using free content online. And so links into the ethos for this podcast, but also the methodology that they've used. And I think you get loads of value out. If you've enjoyed this episode, I think you'd really enjoy the book, but I'm biased on both those things, so take what you want from that. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for sharing or coming to the event if you do. Thank you very much for supporting me in any way that you do, whether that be coming down to the event, sharing a link to the event, sharing a link to this podcast, or buying my book. I will see you all in about 15 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.